Welcome to the Wildly Capable Podcast by NovoEd, hosted by Todd Moran and Alex Gruen. On Wildly Capable, we explore unusual sources of deep capabilities and unexpected insights on human capital. On this episode, Todd and I interview Chris Ferrando, Senior Director and Head of Organization Effectiveness at Subway. Chris, as it turns out, we've had a couple of guests on the podcast before you that also come from military backgrounds. Chris Bavona spent 5 years in the Army Medical Services Corps. Rebecca Stein, UPenn, was in the Israeli Army. She actually shared with us that instructional design was developed in the Army. So let's start with your experience at the U.S. Coast Guard Academy. Maybe tell our listeners a little bit about the Crucible as a starting point and other experiences at the Academy that shaped your leadership capability, as well as your perspective on organizational capabilities later on.
Sure. So, you know, Warren Bennis, had said that every leader has to go through a crucible, some type of event or experience that really tests them as a leader. And that's where the name, the Crucible, came from. And so at the Coast Guard Academy, cadets would go through a week long of kind of classroom learning, learning to understand the basic fundamentals of, you know, leadership, from self-awareness to, you know, leading others. And so we created this Crucible experience to really put a lot of this to the test. And so it basically starts out very early in the morning. And in this case, it simulated a pilot that had crashed in the woods. And so you bring a small group of cadets together. There's no rank. They're all equal. And they get some equipment. They get a little bit of training. They get some resources. And they're basically said, you have to find the pilot with the information that you have. And then you have to carry that individual the remainder of the day and get to an extraction point. And we simulated a helicopter with a pickup truck. And so the nice thing was that we decided we could manipulate variables of each team to see how manipulating those variables impacts the performance of each team. So this first team in the morning, we took a small team. We gave them the resources that they needed, but we didn't give them any training on how to use the resources. So we gave them GPS device, handheld GPS devices, but we didn't teach them how to use it. And so you have no leader. We didn't really give them, the only goal we gave them was, you know, find the pilot, get them to the extraction point. And so we would go along with each team and monitor and see, you know, what they did. And what we discovered with that first team was that without having the training, they spent a lot of time trying to figure out how to get things to work. The team began to fracture. Half the team felt they should go one way. Half the team felt they should go the other way. So you would start to see members of the team start, you know, heading down the railroad tracks away from one another. End of the day, it took them almost a full 8 hours to actually complete the exercise. Next time we did it, we had a similar size team. This time we gave them all the same resources. We gave them training on those resources, and we gave them a mid goal to kind of hit and an end goal. And they went through. They actually did better. It took them probably about 6.5 hours to complete the exercise. Now, all through the day, they have to come across a number of obstacles. There were actually like 10 obstacles. One was they had to load the individual into a life raft and then row down river. Well, we would flip them over in the river so that when they came ashore, they're cold and shivering and their food is all wet. So again, we want to see, you know, do they give up? And so with this one, we gave them a little bit of feedback and they ended up performing a little bit better. On the last group, we nearly doubled the size of the team to like 16 people. But again, no leader. And we say, but this time we're giving you the equipment you need. We're giving you all of the training you need to be effective and successful. We're giving you short, mid, and a final goal. And we're going to give you constant feedback throughout the entire day. And the theory was this group is too big to actually be effective without a leader. And they completely blew us away. They ended up finishing the obstacle course in under 5 hours. And they were the only team that completed all 10 obstacles successfully. And one of the most remarkable things was, you know, we had staggered the team. So the team, one team started out real early in the morning. Next team started out, you know, about an hour or so after the first one. And then we launched the third one about an hour, hour and a half after the second one. And so at about halfway through the obstacle course, this big, large team, you could see them, their effort kind of starting to falter. They're getting tired. And I immediately said, hey, look up there on the ridge. You see who that is? That's the second team. You've almost made up an hour and a half time on them. And this team, like they doubled their pace. They went from being real tired, I attributed it to the fact that they got immediate feedback that they were so close to their goal, and you can see it. And they ended up bypassing the other team. And then later, towards on the very last stretch, now they've been carrying, you know, a 150-pound individual for the last, you know, 4 hours or so. So they're getting tired. It got to the point where people started falling down because their legs were so weak. And I'll never forget, they needed four people to carry the stretcher, and they just were cycling people through, taking turns because they were so tired. And I'll never forget, they had one guy carrying it, and somebody came up, tapped him on the shoulder and said, you can rotate off, it's your turn. And he goes, I'm strong. Let somebody else who needs it go, but I'll keep going. And it's little things like that really reinforce, you know, what teamwork is, what sacrifice is. Even though it was his turn and he could get off, he decided that he could best help his team by continuing to do work and allowing somebody else who was more in need of rest to get it.
Chris, to think of the sense of selflessness and sacrifice and being cognizant of where you are in that moment in time in support of teammates. I mean, there's so much to unpack in there. And I love the theme that you said, immediate feedback, but the piece that stood out to me to get that effectively 37% gain in productivity, if I'm going to make a analogous motion to the business world, was the continuous feedback part of that in your mind, or was that just a small component? Because I know we put a huge degree of emphasis on the continuous feedback model in sort of the L&D construct of how we deploy learning and development opportunities.
Yeah, no, I'm glad you brought that up. That was one part of kind of what I can call this recipe of success. You know, so one aspect was, make sure that your people have the resources that they need to get the job done. Make sure that they're trained on those resources to get the job done. Make sure that they have short, mid, and long-term goals. You know, if you just give somebody kind of this big, what could seem like an undaunting task, you know, it could very easily, you know, defeat somebody kind of mentally. But let's break it down into, you know, here's the first goal I want you to hit. Then once you get that, carry kind of that short dopamine rush of succeeding, carry it for momentum to the next goal, and then carry that even further to the end goal. So give them goals, and then give them feedback. And the third piece that I think oftentimes is undervalued is mindset. Absolutely. If you're working on a team of people that have that that common shared mindset of we're all a part of something bigger than ourselves, you'll never go wrong.
Yeah, it's even almost a little bit of vestiges of sort of the growth mindset, like this willingness to sort of lean into to team and other, and the belief that I could get better, stronger, faster, more efficient, and sort of willingness to learn. I love. Can I lean into the teamwork theme a little bit more, because it's so important, Chris, that you touched on. I know you've said in the past that you believe, you know, true teamwork requires that every member subordinate themselves and their ego to the team, and that whereas you've witnessed that and so poetically recounted the story to us, the Coast Guard, of seeing that firsthand when observing special ops teams or others in sort of that environment, I think you're stating that you have more rarely or maybe never observed true teamwork in a business setting, but you've come close to seeing it. And, you know, our audience, largely listener-wise, made up of leaders in L&D, HR, talent space. Can you talk a little bit about maybe some examples of the come close and how you think we might be able to get closer to driving to teamwork at scale? And does L&D have a part to play in that?
Yeah. So, you know, I think one of the experiences that I had that had me re-examine, you know, business teams was I was at a military base in Florida, and part of what I was there for was to observe special operations teams and, you know, look at some of the characteristics. So when I got there, I went to the gym, and one of the first things that I noticed was guy from the Air Force, I think two guys from the Army and one from the Navy, and they all had their respective service shirts on. They worked out together. I saw them running together. I saw them at the mess hall together. The next day I saw them, the same guys, at the gym together. And I finally went up and I said, hey, you know, I've been watching you and I noticed that you're never without one another. And I was just, you know, could you explain that a little bit to me? And they basically said, you know, we've been assigned a mission. And so to prepare for that, we have to learn to know everything we can about each other, so that we will be successful. And I've kept that in the back of my mind, as that's the kind of mindset. You know, it's not about me, it's not about my service, it's all about the mission. And so it's that same mindset in an organization. Is it's whatever your company's mission is, whatever your team objective is, if it's to create an exceptional customer experience, then we have to come together and each one of us has to do our part and really put that first. You know, a lot of times organizational initiatives like this become complicated because people are thinking, well, how come I'm not in charge? Or I wonder if I'm going to get a better performance rating. Am I going to get a promotion out of this? I wonder if they're getting, you know, a bigger pay raise than I am. Who's going to get the exposure for this? Who gets the opportunity to present in front of senior leadership? And all of that distracts from the mindset. And then that can begin to erode the performance of the team.
Yeah, that idea of too much of sort of this sort of inside oriented thinking and sort of driving and dictating behavior versus sort of this external focus on team org, you know, greater purpose, candidly, to that level. I think that's a theme, at least I'm hearing a little bit in that side of it, which is hard to subordinate oneself to that because it's not our natural inclination as humans to be, to be out for self a little bit.
I saw it quite a bit at ESPN. Is probably the closest thing. And we used to joke. I used to joke around with the people at ESPN because, you know, they would ask me, you know, what's life like in the service? And I said, you'll go long periods of time without seeing your family. You're going to work incredibly hard. Sometimes not having all the resources that you need. There'll be times when you are cold and hungry and you'll go without sleep and you make a lot of sacrifices. And then someone one time after I'd been at ESPN for a while said, so what's it like working at ESPN? And I said, for some, you'll be away from your family for a long period of time. There'll be times when you're cold and hungry. There'll be times when you won't get much sleep. I said, working at ESPN is really a lot like being in the military. And it was true. I probably some of the hardest working, most authentic people that I've ever had the privilege of working with. And they truly, the only thing that mattered to them while I was there was creating great sports content. And if they had to work longer hours, they would. If somebody needed help, they would, because all these things had to be done in the name of creating great sports content for the leader in sports.
Chris, you wrote about the canoe effect in one of your posts on LinkedIn. Everybody's swimming in the same direction together. Can you riff a little bit on that? And also the notion of developing and articulating a mission such that it seeps down into organizations, especially in times where things are changing, you know, very quickly. You know, how do you bring different leaders, different teams together around a central mission when everybody might feel like they've got competing ideas around that mission?
Yeah. So kind of the idea around the canoe effect, one of the training experiences in the military, particularly if you're in the Navy or the Coast Guard, is they have a simulator where you basically go into a ship and they start to flood the ship. And as more water comes on, the ship, the simulator begins to, you know, keel over. And you've got burst pipes, you've got big holes in the hull and water just flooding in. And you have to work together as a team and get everything patched up. You can't say, well, I did my job. I patched up my hole, but you didn't. You're on the same boat. It either stays afloat or it sinks. And so the canoe effect is basically the same thing. And maybe, you know, maybe growing up, you had that time on the lake where you were in a canoe and somebody just started throwing water. So that's how I analogize it, is the canoe effect is, you know, if you're all in the same canoe and somebody starts throwing water into it and you're told your goal is to keep this canoe afloat, you're gonna work like crazy to get all that water out. Now, if you take two different teams, let's say sales and marketing, you know, great natural rivalry there in a lot of organizations. If you put sales and marketing in respective canoes on the water, and you tell them the goal is to keep the canoes afloat, and they start filling up, and then you come along and you start poking a bunch of holes in the canoes, and the water starts rushing in. Each team is going to be frantically trying to keep their own canoe afloat, and somebody in marketing might look over and go, "Hey, look, sales is almost underwater." They're probably going to watch them and say, "Well, they've got their own problems to deal with. We've got to work on our boat." But if the next day you take sales and marketing and you put them in the same canoe and poke a bunch of holes in, it starts filling up. If sales is at the front of the boat and marketing's at the back, and somebody sees that the back of the boat's going down a lot faster, I'll guarantee you they're going to start taking their shirts off and passing whatever buckets they can, because now they're in the same boat. You know, so I, you know, in a few organizations where I've gone, I've advocated strongly, get rid of individual goals. Individual goals oftentimes can pit people against one another. You know, I can remember coworkers saying, you know, somebody would ask them for help and they'd be like, "Sorry, it's end of year. I have my own goals I have to focus on. I don't have any time to help you." And so to the extent that you can, I try to advocate, give teams the same goal. Sales, marketing, your only goal is sales. So sales, you better make sure that marketing is, you know, providing you the materials that you need. This is an actual true story. I was talking to a pharmaceutical sales team one time, and I was looking at costs. Somebody mentioned, well, one of our big costs is the cost of, you know, rental facilities around the company. And I'm like, rental facilities? Why would you need rental facilities? And he said, well, you know, those, like, those small spaces you can go and rent, you know, on a month to month basis. We need a place to store all the marketing materials that we don't use, because marketing doesn't listen to what we tell them. marketing doesn't understand the customers, the patients. They don't understand the doctors. So they spend millions of dollars on marketing materials. We have to rent storage facilities to store all these materials in until we can legally destroy them. And I said, that's got to be one of the craziest things I've ever heard, is that we're spending millions of dollars to hide the marketing materials because the two teams could not work together. And I can't make that up.
Chris, I can second that. I won't name any names because we count some of our pharmaceutical partners and clients in high regard. But my wife worked in the space and literally had that exact scenario. And I remember counting it, store and lock, the, you know, to 5x10 facility we had to rent to house just that, which just seemed absurd on so many levels. Hence the individual goal. Absurd.
Chris, you've mentioned so far sports entertainment, you've dropped Start Pharmaceuticals, you're in the Coast Guard. So you've worked in organizational effectiveness across a bunch of different industries over the course of your career, and at some of these industries' biggest brands. Financial services at Phoenix, entertainment at ESPN, like you talked about, pharmaceuticals, life sciences, personal care, consumer goods, you talked about at L'Oreal, and now you're QSR at Subway. So was the cross-industry trajectory by design?
No. It was always opportunity. And it's funny because one of the, earlier in my career, I would, one question that would often come up in interviews was, why do you think you'll be successful in our industry? Our industry is not like any other. We're very different. And I would often say, you're actually more alike than you believe, because every industry thinks that they are unique, when in fact they are not. There's nothing unique really about industries. And I'll often say, what is the one thing that every single industry shares in common? The one thing. And people eventually come and go, they have people. And I go, that's right. And you know, and so if we look at, what have been those things that have really transformed, how you've approached your career, there have been two. One goes back to Capella. And at Capella, there was a Dr. Diamond. He goes, he said, the fluttering of butterfly wings on one side of the world will create a tsunami on the other. And he said, you should check out chaos theory. So I checked out, I started to read, chaos theory and from Edward Lorenz. That led me to the one that totally transformed my entire career and my whole outlook on life in general, which was Ludwig von Bertalanffy, Austrian botanist. And basically he would go to a pond and just study the ecosystem. And then he later became a cancer specialist, oncologist, and ended his career teaching up in Canada. But towards the end of his life, he took everything that he learned about nature and he applied it to organizations. And he said, if you really want to understand how organizations operate, all you need to understand is chemistry, biology, thermodynamics. He said, if you understand natural sciences, because all an organization is another organism. And if you think about the way that organizations are structured, it's not that. It's very similar to the human body. The basic building block is the cell. Groups of cells forms tissue. Groups of tissues forms organs. Groups of organs form systems. Systems form the human body. What's the basic building block of an organization? It's the employee. Groups of employees form teams. Teams form departments. Departments form functions. And so I've taken a very naturalistic approach to organizations. And then years ago, I had the privilege of having lunch with the late professor emeritus at Wharton, Russ Acuff. And at the time, I mean, the guy was still sharp as a whip. And I'm having private lunch with him, and he's still getting around the room. He's like 80 at the time, getting around the room on a walker. And so we sit down at lunch, and I said to him, I go, you know, I'm listening to you. I'm starting to think that people are the root cause of every problem in an organization. And the guy stood up from the table, he pounded his fist, and he goes, people will always be the root cause of every problem. He said, because people are the only things capable of learning. He said, process cannot learn and change itself. Technology can't learn and change itself. They're inert. Organizational design can't change itself. He said, you have to look at the people. And one of his fundamental laws about systems is that the most flexible part of any system is what actually drives it. And for organizations, it's people. But we spend so much time blaming process, blaming structure, blaming policy, when that's absurd. They can't change themselves. What you have to do is you have to look at who owns the process, who picked the technology, who's refusing to look at new technology. It will always be people. And if you understand that, and that, so I come full circle. People will ask me, well, how is it you've been able to transition from industry to industry, you know, successfully? And it's because I understand people. And that's what I've tried to make my career focused on, is understand people, understand them psychologically, understand them behaviorally, in very multifaceted ways. And when you understand the basic building block of something, you can transcend, you know, any boundaries or divisions if you have that fundamental understanding and mindset.
Chris, you would get no argument from Alex or I about the criticality of the people component being the building block and foundation of every org, which, so I love how eloquently you spoke about that in your trajectory. So let me pose this one to you, because I think as we sit sort of 3 years on into, I won't even say other side of pandemic, because it's here to stay. Sort of the fact that we can't be all in that pond together in terms of co-location, and hybrid is the model that we have to figure out how the people component carries forward in all facets of executing business, of learning and developing together, the way that you spoke about. What is your take on sort of the continued reality of hybrid being the nature of sort of our workplace moving forward, and then the other parts of process, technology, individuals that need to sort of bend to that or press against it? I'd love to get your perspective there, because I think you probably have a unique one.
Yeah, so the hybrid one, I think, is one that you know, many organizations are still trying to figure out. You know, for me, I think it's, you know, continuing to experiment with different approaches, you know, different technologies. I'm constantly interacting with other professionals to hear kind of what they're using. Regardless of what technology you use, to me, it's about bringing people together. You know, and I had mentioned to you previously about Ikujiro Nanaka. He's essentially considered the father of Japanese knowledge management. He's like the Japanese Drucker. And he basically said that, you know, that knowledge is the only self-renewing resource that a company has. And the more you use it, the more you gain. And it's a fascinating concept, because if I take a dollar out of my pocket, and if I give that dollar to Alex, Alex now has the dollar, but I don't. It's not a self-renewing resource. But if I share, as we're doing now, if I share something with Alex about characteristics of a high-performing team, he now has that full knowledge. I retain that full knowledge, but now he can integrate it with his own knowledge and experience and create new knowledge. And then he shares that with you. and then you expand it and share it with somebody else. So the more that we share, so I've comically referred to, you know, employees as weapons of mass construction or weapons of mass deconstruction, but it's about bringing people together, bringing their thoughts together. So, you know, if it's only by phone, if it's by, you know, computer, if it's in a room, what matters most is that we're connecting not just the people, but what each one of those individuals is capable of. And if you think about a brain and intelligence, the more neurons that become interconnected, the greater the intelligence and the intellectual capacity of that brain. And so you want to get into this idea of hyperconnectivity. Same thing in an organization is get beyond the silos, find ways to hyperconnect, and then to just engage in this generation and mass proliferation of knowledge and to leverage every available technology and resource. If it's a smartphone, if it's an app, if it's a survey, if it's an email, but find ways to generate knowledge, centralize it, and then distribute it.
So just to throw something really quick out here. So Nanaka, right? Knowledge creating company, Kevin Budelman introduced me to that particular piece. And the reason why it's relevant right now, particularly for you, Todd, is that, and Chris, for some context, last year we were recalibrating our product demo internally, and we needed a new name for the company that we're using as part of our demo. It's called The Wise Company internally, and that came directly from Nonaka. So,
great.
You are preaching to the choir here in all the best ways. So I will now throw this back over to Todd.
Yeah, this theme of, I love the analogy of you know, sort of the weapons of mass construction, because there's a huge part that when we engage with clients and talk about the power of sort of the co-creation, so shared time spent, hyperconnectivity, and then this idea of sort of build anew and within and across one another. And the people part is the core of that. So you know, when we put the L&D lens on it, of the org structures you're describing, to us, it's not just about individual pursuit of knowledge, it's about how can you then sort of share that, augment that, cascade that, disseminate that in sort of a peer-based learning approach, because that's who we are as social animals, back to the pond, a little bit, learning with, from, and through one another. I would love to get your take, Chris, maybe as we sort of come a bit to a close here of, you know, you work probably intently with the talent teams, with other parts of HR teams, with L&D teams. How much do you think this idea of sort of the learning and development angle, whether it's in hybrid or as people are navigating those waters, how important should that be an emphasis for organizations on sort of the sort of 2023 path and route as you look ahead and help sort of steward listeners as to what lies in the coming 12 months?
Yeah. So, you know, in my role, I'm fortunate enough to be able to under the umbrella of organizational effectiveness, I have talent management, leadership development, employee learning, and organizational design and development. So it creates a great opportunity to ensure consistency and alignment through what we're doing. And you know, so one of the things that we're embarked on right now is we had recently had a reorg, and what I've seen in a lot of organizations is once they have a reorg, they kind of still stay in their own silos. And what we did was we basically, once the reorg was made, then we called the key leaders of every single one of those areas to an offsite for an alignment meeting. And we said, all right, we have to get out everything that is on your mind. You know, if policy, process, procedure, roles, communications, everything. It has to be, you know, orchestrated and designed for optimal performance. You know, and again, I'll always go back to the human body. And if you think about the human body, the bones is what gives it structure. But that's really all the bone is designed for, is to provide structure. That's the same thing with an organizational chart. It's just structure. And I'll ask groups, I'll say, so what gives the body, what gives the human body the capability of flexibility, dexterity, movement, and motion, and therefore adaptability? And that, and they'll go, muscle. And I'll go, no, muscle is strength. Muscle is your talent and your people. But what gives the body motion? And they eventually go, it's the joints. And I said, that's right. And I'm like, that's where you get motion from. And I said, what forms the joints of organizations? It's communications, it's relationships, it's getting to know people, it's collaboration, it's what is between teams. The teams is the structure, it's the bones. What's gonna give those teams motion, momentum, adaptability, and success is how well they communicate, how well they are aligned. If your organization is not performing well, don't look at individuals and teams. That rarely will you find issues there. It's often going to be in the communications. It's going to be the ligaments, the tendons of a company. It's that which connects teams.
Love that analogy back to the power and the specificity of purpose with parts of human body related to the organizational side of things.
Yeah, and really, if you think about it, information and data is basically the circulatory system of an organization. Making sure that the right people have the right information, that it's timely, that it's accurate, so that they can make the best possible decision. So I tell people, if you want to understand an organization, study the human body. And then once you understand that, look at the organization and you will see it in a completely different way.
We'll have to have another conversation about this, cybernetics and Stafford Beer and Heart of the Enterprise, Brain of the Firm. But I think related, you know, and at the end of 2022, we're recording in December 2022, right before the new year and heading into 2023, Chris, one biological symptom of potentially problematic organizations is fear, you know? And so want to close with your take on how to overcome fear to be a doer if you're a spectator or roadkill, as you've positioned this in the past. That let's close out with that, and with maybe a hopeful outlook on how to become a doer in 2023.
Yeah, I'm glad you chose to end that, because I just had this conversation with my daughter last night, and I said, to build up your self-confidence, you want to do things that scare you. The problem is that fear is the most powerful emotion we have. And it's designed to protect us. It's designed for, you know, our survival. The problem is that it's like a pair of gravity boots. It will keep people firmly planted where they are. Fear of failure, fear of rejection, fear of making a mistake, fear of how people will look at me, fear of loss. And so when you study like entrepreneurs, and people that are, you know, really stepping out from the mainstream and making things happen, there's lots of failure often associated with them, but that's part of the journey. And they're not failing, they're learning forward. And so every time you do something that scares you, you realize, I was able to accomplish that. That wasn't so bad, and you move on to the next thing. And so the people that overcome their fear are the ones that really start to make things happen. And that's what those are the doers, the initiators. Then there's the individuals that They watch other people make things happen. These are the people that kind of stand on the sidewalk and cheer as others run by, or sometimes maybe throw things at them to slow them down, to make themselves feel better about, you know, their own complacency, you know, and not doing anything. So those are what I consider the spectators. They watch people make things happen. And then that last kind of category of people are the ones that wake up, you know, later in life, and feel like they got run over, and they're like, wow, what happened? I've gotten to this point in my career and I've really not accomplished much. And all they're left with is regret. So are you an initiator? Are you a spectator? Or are you destined to be run over by life and become basically roadkill? And the beautiful thing about it is it's our choice. We get to choose. You know, I've had my share of fear, but I learned early on that the only way you overcome fear is by facing it. So do something that you fear. You know, for me, my biggest fear is snakes, but I live on the town reservoir. I have lots of snakes. So what I do is I try to catch snakes. I don't like it, but I've become more comfortable at doing it. And people will ask me, well, why don't you just kill the snake? And I'm like, because then I have succumbed to my fear. And I realize that snake is more afraid of me than I of it. So the fear makes us do irrational, illogical things. Fear of public speaking. If you have a fear of public speaking, then you should be doing as much public speaking as you possibly can. And you know, just as a last anecdote, we had taken some cadets from the Coast Guard Academy to a ropes course at Quantico, Virginia. And you know, it was one of those tree courses, ropes courses through the trees. Spend all day doing that. End of the day, the drill instructor says, okay, the cadets have had enough fun. Now it's time for the instructors and facilitators to enjoy themselves. Who wants to run through the combat skills course? And I was like, hey, that sounds fun. So I raised my hand, and he goes, okay, great. I'm going to have a staff sergeant here run through the course quickly and clear out the rattlesnakes. And all of a sudden I'm like, oh, maybe I want to rethink this. But then I realized I've got to face my fears. And they said, wear clothes that you can throw away, because your clothes will be so trashed at the end. We have a barrel where you just will throw your clothes away at the end. And he wasn't lying. You know, all these obstacles, everything. And we did it as a team. We helped each other. And at the end, that it was one of those moments where you realize, if I can do that, there's not much else I don't think I can't do. And you carry that momentum and that learning into the next thing that scares you. So I try to pass that on to my daughter. I try to pass that on to other employees. When you see that they're afraid of doing something, is if you're afraid of it, it's telling you that it needs to be done.
NovoEd empowers organizations to build deep capabilities rather than mere skills through cohort-based learning that drives true readiness to perform on the job. For more episodes of the Wildly Capable podcast, or for more information on NovoEd, please visit us at novoed.com.